And at this time, the group would like to welcome our guest speaker tonight, Mary Beth from Neptune, New Jersey.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Mary Beth, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very, very grateful to be here tonight with all of you on such a beautiful, gorgeous night. Just looking out there fills my life. My life is so filled today and with stuff that I have learned to come to appreciate and be thankful for. And today I want to show up for life. And that was not the case, certainly when I came back into these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes even in Alcoholics Anonymous, presently, I can get to that place. So I know that I have a daily reprieve based on my fit spiritual condition. So I'm very grateful to be here. And I just looked at the clock, and it says 8:11, and that's my birthday. On August 11th, I'm going to be older than a lot of you guys. I'm not going to say my age, but I have to tell you, I didn't think I'd get anywhere near this birthday, that's for sure. God sure has a funny way of doing the opposite of what I think I need and what I want. And thank God his plans up to this point have won out. My home group is the Design for Living. We meet on Sunday nights in Neptune at 7 o'clock in New Jersey. We're a big book study group, and Sarah has been down there. And any of you, if you're ever down that way in New Jersey, please come visit us. We'd love to have you. We're a very enthusiastic big book group. We get anywhere from the first from our first meeting a little over 6 years ago up to the present time. On any given Sunday night, we can have over 200 people there studying the big book, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And you know, it's a book that certainly has saved my life, or the book, not the book itself, but the experience that I have had with it. So please come visit us. And we just started a second meeting in Asbury Park on a Wednesday night in Atonement Church, and it's a speaker format kind of like this. We have a 10-minute speaker with 5 years or less and a 45-minute speaker with 5 years or more. So if you're ever in Asbury on a Wednesday night from 7 to 8:15 at the Atonement Church, please, we'd love to have you. We'd love to have you. My sobriety date is November 23rd, 1996. And that was the morning that God did for me what I couldn't do for myself, when I said the six most important words I've ever said, and that's, I'm an alcoholic. I need help. God listened to me that morning when I didn't want him to, when I didn't understand what that would mean, and in spite of my pride and my ego and my self-centeredness and my selfishness and all those defects, he still listens to me today. I have a sponsor, you know, Christian in the beginning, he read a couple of really important things that today, for me, are so important. And that's, you know, if you're in this program, if you're in a 12-step program, do the 12 steps. Get a home group. Have a commitment in that home group. Get a service commitment. Get a sponsor. Go through the 12 steps with that sponsor so you can turn around and give it away. That means that you will be in all three sides of the triangle, unity, service, and recovery. And that's what helps keep me in AA and not on the outskirts. Because when I'm on the outskirts, I'm in trouble. I've got to be in it, you know, to win it. And so please, and, you know, I'm just going to share my experience with you. You know, something I heard early on that was really, really important for me was to identify and not compare. So our stories may be very, very different. But if you can identify with the way I drank, with the way I felt, with the way I feel, you know, you're supposed to be here too. Comparing can make me unique and different and on the outskirts, and I'm in trouble when that stuff happens. See, I only have two choices today. I'm either growing closer to or further away. Closer to the God of my own understanding or further away from Him. And the further away I go, the sicker I can get, even in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had experience with all of that stuff. So like it says, you know, in a general way, I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like for me today. And just those three statements are completely different experiences. What it was like before I picked up the drink, what happened when I picked up my first drink, up until the time that I stopped for good and for all, and what my life is like now, is like going to see three completely different movies. Completely different. And, you know, this movie is still playing. You know, it's still being written. There's no ending to it yet. So, I'm one of eight, Irish Catholic, born to loving parents, a loving mother and father. I'm the third oldest, six girls and two boys. And the more I stay in AA, the longer I stay in AA and the more work I do on myself, my story changes. Even this part of my story, because I'm really beginning to understand it really for what it was worth. And being the third, being one of eight, allowed me to escape pretty easily. And being the third oldest, having a sister who was older than me, who was just really, really bad growing up, you know, made it very easy for me to escape and go down a certain path. And when I first came into AA, I wanted to, like, blame my parents, you know. I would have blamed anyone. I would have blamed you, even if I didn't know you, for what had happened in my life. I still sometimes want to blame people. That's why I have to keep coming. But, you know, I wanted to just blame anyone for what had happened in my life. But I come to realize, through this 12-step process and through the sponsorship and the teachers, that it all started with me, you know, stays with me and ends with me. You know, my life is one of contradiction. And I'll talk about so many contradictions that I've learned about myself, you know, through this process. So around the age of 13, I had my first drink. In the backyard, it was in, you know, a summer night, and my parents always had parties. So my perception of alcohol, even before I picked it up, because this is definitely a disease of perception, and the way I can perceive life today can still be really, really way off, you know, like it talks about in the doctor's opinion, full flight from reality. My reality can really be, you know, checked out. But my perception of alcohol was fun. You know, my parents always had, there was always a party for everything. You know, there were like eight kids in every family, and there was just, you know, a close-knit community, and so every night was a party, and it was always either in our backyard or in our kitchen. So drinking was just always a part of our lives. And it always seemed like it was fun, but I do remember now looking back that there came a point in time when there was a shift in what was going on. And always Mass first. I was raised Catholic, so there was always Mass. So you never drank before the 5 o'clock Mass. Then Mass, and then let the parties begin. And, you know, what would be fun and jovial and excitement in the beginning at 5:30 at night, by the time the party ended, there was just havoc with these adults. you know, screaming, fighting, you know, just you name it. So I knew that at somewhere along the line there was going to be a shift. And that's exactly what happened with me, with my drinking. So I have my first beer, Rheingold beer. So I know I'm dating myself. I know you young guys probably don't even know what it is. But anyway, Rheingold beer in the backyard. And I can remember it like it was yesterday. I took that drink, and that drink took me. The ease and comfort of that first sip. Again, now remember, I'm seeing that it's fun. Older brother and sister, they're doing it. Kids are doing it. Everyone's sneaking in the bushes. You know, the whole bit. Like it says in Bill's story, I had arrived. I was that ease and comfort within changed my whole perception of life that night. I could become whoever it was you wanted me to be. Because up until that point, I didn't even realize how uncomfortable it was being me, being in my skin and not feeling like one of. And that changed that night for me with that beer. Now, I can't tell you what happened that night, and I don't remember when the next day was that I had another drink or what happened, but I can quickly tell you the progression of my disease. Because for a lot of years, I had a blast. I had the time of my life in high school. I went to Columbia High School in Maplewood. It was South Orange and Maplewood. My graduating class was 775 people. And I loved it. I loved everything about it. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to stick to the singleness of purpose, but I will tell you drugs are a big part of my story. I don't think there was one morning in 4 years that I didn't get high every day. And, you know, weekends and just partying and, you know, going to the neighborhood bar when you're 16. And I was getting into trouble. And, when I was getting reprimanded for stuff and I was getting grounded and... But I couldn't wait to do it again. I could not wait to do it again. And for a lot of years, it was the time of my life. But when I sit down with a teacher and she starts to explain to me what it is I suffer from, I start to get the clarity of just how my drinking really progressed. And what was a lot of fun in high school, where I was starting to have consequences from it, quickly progressed to college, where I graduated from college. I went to a school that my dad worked at that was right around the corner, so I didn't go away to college, and there wasn't any dorms. But I was going out with a guy for a really long time who lived down the shore, and I lived up north, so every weekend was spent, you know, down there, and that was kind of like when I would go to escape. And I got through college in 4.5 years, maybe closer to 5. But that was only because I could, not because of grades or anything like that. And my drinking was taking on a lot more serious proportions. And it wasn't just a weekend thing for me. And, that obsession that started back in the backyard at 13, when can I do it again, really was galloping through my life. And weekends turned into Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then just, you know, sometimes around the clock, sometimes not taking breaks for a really long time. You know, having no idea really where it was going to take me on any given night, because I had no control over it. You know, once I started, I couldn't stop. I graduated college, and, you know, I thought that it was going to be time to settle down with this guy that I had been dating for a really long time, and, you know, the white picket fence and getting married and the, you know, four kids and the dog. And he had very different plans. And shortly after I graduated from college, he dumped me. And again, another point in my life where a specific situation had such a profound impact on the way I felt inside. And the humiliation, the pain, the suffering, the pride, the ego. I can remember, and I'm talking, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I don't even know how long ago it was. I can remember my mom sitting down telling me not to worry, that one day I would realize that it was the best thing that could ever happen to me. And this was when I was 26, so almost 30 years ago. And I just realized what she meant by that 6 months ago when I got to see this person again. So it took 30 years for me to realize. You know, I had a spiritual experience that night when I was at the funeral of someone. And I walked out of that funeral home knowing, feeling inside exactly what my mother said to me 30 years prior to that. But that caused my drinking to just escalate through the roof. And I took such a turn in my life where all bets were off. And I was drinking around the clock. I was hanging out with people I shouldn't have been hanging out with. I was doing stuff I shouldn't have been doing. I was drinking to stop shaking, not drinking, trying not to drink, changing, moving, geographics, going so many different places. Within a 10-year period, my drinking got so bad and had escalated so off the charts that I wound up living in a condo in Basking Ridge, New Jersey, which was like, I didn't even know it existed. And way out in 78, I had been working. I worked for the same company through all of this for almost 32 years. I actually just left the company this past February. But I had been living out in this condo in Basking Ridge, pretty much drinking for oblivion, like it talks about in Bill's story. And there were days when I could drink. Well, at this point, I was no longer drinking beer. And I had switched, and I was trying to just find the right mix and, you know, the right control and what I mixed, you know, so that I wouldn't have the same effect. And at the end of my drinking, I was drinking gin and Diet Pepsi. And, you know, right? Go figure. Thank God they didn't have recycling back then, because I lived in this town in Basking Ridge where I could have filled the dumpster with gin bottles and probably one bottle of Diet Pepsi. But I was living out in this town, way out on 78, trying to escape. And like I just said to Jim tonight, I didn't realize that I was the problem. So I kept bringing myself wherever I went. And I pretty much was working maybe out of 8 hours, 1 or 2 hours, shaking in the morning, getting something to drink to go into work if I even showed up, coming home, pulling the blinds down, just drinking to black out, to escape. I was too afraid to try to kill myself, and I literally had died on the inside, and I was in so much pain, so much fear, so lost, and my pride and my ego just wouldn't allow me to ask for help. I'm not a first-time winner in this program. I knew from the get-go for a long time that I did not drink like other normal people. I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1986 and stayed for about 5 minutes. And so I had 10 more years of research and development out there. And to fast forward to, you know, to the last couple of days of my drinking, there had been many, many, many instances. Some brushes with the law, never jail, a miracle that I never, ever killed anyone because I drank and drive pretty much almost every single day. I would smash up cars constantly. My mother kept asking me what was wrong, and I'd always say, you know, someone sideswiped me. And, you know, she would always ask me, you know, what was wrong with me, and I'd say nothing because, you know, I came from the type of family where there's an elephant in the middle of the room and you don't talk about it, you know, and there was just so much going on inside of our family, and no one said anything, you know, like you'd fall down, you know, the stairs drunk or high on Thanksgiving, and people, you know, they just turn their heads, and you just don't talk about it, you know, we just don't talk about anything. It doesn't leave the four walls of the house. And, you know, but my mother and my dad and everyone, I wasn't fooling anyone. You know, we think that we're fooling all these people, and they know way before we do. And so I was living out in Baskin Ridge, and at this point, for probably the last month of my drinking, I was drinking wine, white wine, the only time I've ever, ever in my life since 13 years old, drank white wine. I thought it was for sissies, hated the taste of it. But let me tell you, I was trying for years to try to get the right combination here to control what was happening to me, and I thought maybe wine was the answer. And so, of course, I'd get these huge gallons of wine before I could even go anywhere. I couldn't even go to the dentist or the doctor without drinking. I'd have those big plastic cups and just fill them and think I'm fooling everyone, and gin and Diet Pepsi or ice, whatever. And so this particular night, I'm at my dad's house down in Seagirt. My mom had died in 1991 at the age of 59. And that was another pivotal turning point in my life where, you know, I said to God, like, I blamed God for my mom's death. And she died a horrible death of cancer. She suffered terribly for about 6 months, and I made the whole thing about me. Thank God for inventory and good sponsorship to get me clear on this stuff because, you know, I was like, God, how could you take my mother from me? You know, it didn't matter that she suffered tremendously. And so when she died, I mean, you know, that was just another really pivotal turning point in my life of just walking away from the God of my understanding and just hating everything and everyone. And, you know, typical day in my mind and my thinking is waking up in the morning, I'm not going to drink today. God, please don't let me drink today. Or coming to. I never woke up. I came to for the last 15 years. Hour or two would pass, and it's on my mind. I have to go to the liquor store. I'm only going to have one. Just one. That's it. Maybe two. And then I'd be the one, if I'm still at the bar at 4 o'clock in the morning, pounding on the bar, how could this have happened to me? How could this have happened again? You know, I went out on Wednesday afternoon. It's Sunday morning. Where did the last 4 days go? Okay? Because blackouts were a big part of my story. So I'm down at my dad's house, which would be November 22nd, 1996, and my niece was with me, and I had custody of her at the time. And she's staying at my sister's house. So I'm staying at my dad's house. My dad had got remarried. And I tell you, I'm one of eight, and we would always get together, like, for everything. You know, we're just extremely close. And we're all close in age, too. You know, there's, like, eight of us. There's, like, 12 years difference between the eight of us. And but this particular night, there was no one home in the house but me. The only time I have ever in my life stayed in that house when they lived in it by myself. And so I drop Brittany off. I go, I get my huge, big bottle of white wine because I have to drink three quarters of it before I can even go out to happy hour. and, you know, meet some people. And my circle of, you know, the host of Fairweather Friends, my circle of friends was just getting smaller and smaller and smaller at this point. And I was meeting a friend of mine who had been my friend. I went to grammar school with her my whole life. And so we were meeting at a bar in Manasquan to have a couple of drinks. And to this day, thank God she doesn't remember, because I just asked her recently, I don't even remember what happened that night. You know, like the last 10 years of my life prior to that. I have no recollection of what happened, of how I got home, or anything. The next morning, November 23rd, I come to, you know, my tongue sticking to the roof of my mouth. Like, oh, my God, my head just, you know, wants to fall off. Like thinking, how did I even get here? And, oh, my God, what did I do the night before? And I get up. And I walk into the bathroom to throw water on my face because my youngest sister, who now works with me, was coming to walk with me that morning. I look in the mirror. Now, at this point, I hadn't been looking in the mirror at myself in a good 15 years because I hated the person I had become. All of my dreams, all of my wishes, all of my values, all of what my parents taught me, all of everything I had been taught was thrown to the wayside because of alcohol and drugs. And I had hated inside, there was a hole in my soul bigger than this farm out here that was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I had hated the person I had become. And I look in the mirror and I have a black eye. And I realize now, you know, I realized it about 3 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I had a spiritual experience that morning when I could feel these hands on my shoulders that morning in the bathroom telling me that I was going to be okay. That was quickly followed, very quickly followed by, like, oh, my God, what the heck just happened? Where did this black eye come from? And I walked back in, and I was sitting at the corner of the bed. My brother-in-law was out mowing the lawn. It was, it happened to be a nice November day. And my sister came upstairs to walk with me, and she said to me, Mary Beth, what happened? And that morning I said the 6 most important words I have ever said: I'm an alcoholic. I need help. They were not my words. That was not my plan. I was trying to scurry in this sick mind. What in God's name am I going to say to explain this? But God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And God listened to me that morning, and it took me years to realize that. And there, up until today, I have embarked on this journey of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I was making a huge revelation to all my brothers and sisters and my dad. It was my dad's birthday, so this is how cool, you know, this fellowship is. Here's a man that I literally put through hell. He thought I had died like 10 times. He just, you know, out of 8 kids. So I say, you know, when I make this huge revelation to all my brothers and sisters, everyone, that I'm an alcoholic, none of them were surprised. Like, every single one of them was like, duh. But remember, I told you, we don't talk about that kind of stuff. We don't say anything about that. So, you know, here I am thinking of making this huge revelation, and they're all looking at me like we knew that years ago. And my dad that night said to me, you know, I've always worried about you more than any of your other brothers and sisters, because I never knew if I was going to get a call one night, you know, saying that you had died. And which, when he said that to me, because you know me, you know, like, ugh, corny is what I thought for a long time, because I could care less about anyone for so long in my life. And 2 days later, I came back in. So the person who's new, stay. I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to a 7:30 meeting, which became my home group for about 2+ years in Morristown, New Jersey. And then I moved, and I've had a couple of different home groups. And so let me tell you about what happened when I came into AA and what my life is like now. So I walk into this meeting. I actually went into my boss at the time, who was in Alcoholics Anonymous, who doesn't mind my breaking his anonymity, told him I needed help. Again, someone who wasn't surprised at all. I was all banged up from falling and with this black eye. And he's the one who told me to go to the meeting the next morning. And, see, I knew the deal. And, see, so by then I was feeling a little bit better. You know, like I didn't have the headache from drinking the gallons of wine and whatever else it was I was drinking that night. And that night at my dad's birthday party, when everyone came over, every time I opened the refrigerator, I saw my big bottle of wine with like this much in it. And I wanted to take that wine that night. I wanted to pick up that bottle of wine and drink it. And it was only God's grace that I'm standing here now and that I did not pick up that wine that night. But I came back into the rooms, and so I came in late because I didn't want to identify myself. I wanted nothing to do with you people. I was starting to feel a little bit better. I'm thinking, oh, my God, I just made the biggest mistake of my life by saying this. And so I come in at about 20 to 8. The meeting had already started, thinking I'm just going to sneak in the outskirts out there where some of you guys are. And not that there's anything wrong with you guys sitting out there in the outskirts, but so I just wanted to sit way in the back and just go unnoticed and just run out of there as soon as the meeting was over. And I walked in, and door slammed shut behind me. You know, I, of course, my perception of it is that the whole room turned around to look at me because it was all about me and saw that, you know, I needed everyone's help. And there was one seat in the middle of this big circle, and that's where I had to sit. So I had to sit smack in the middle of this circle, and everyone around me was talking about God. And I wanted nothing to do with God from the time my mother died, and way before that I had checked out. I thought it was a cult. I wanted absolutely nothing to do with any of you. But I kept coming back. And a woman, Alice, extended her hand to me and spoke to me after that meeting. And I stayed in one side. I started my talk tonight talking about the three sides of the triangle, and they're all equal. I only stayed in one side of those three sides for the first 2.5 years of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was in the fellowship side. A+. I will be forever grateful for my experience, but at about 2+ years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was... that hole in my soul was even bigger. Because now, at 2 years, for me, the pain of not drinking and not changing was more than I could bear. And in a little over 2 years, I was just ready to check out. I hated all of you. I hated my home group. I hated everyone in it. It was a discussion meeting. I didn't, you know, I never even looked at a step. I didn't have a big book. I would drive there and just be like, oh, my God, if this guy talks about his dog and his sailboat, I'm going to hang the dog and slit the sails on the sailboat because I don't want anything to do with any of these people. I was really like, I hated every single one of them. And I moved. I did another geographic, and I was forced to switch home groups. And when I switched home groups, my home group became the Tower Group in the World Trade Center up until September 11th. And there was a woman in that group. I had been through the steps once before, but I wasn't honest. I didn't really understand it. I didn't do it out of the big book. But there was a woman in that group named Lily, who I will be forever grateful for, who was armed with the facts and had a message of depth and weight that she shared with me every single Wednesday across the table at her apartment in Staten Island that catapulted me and rocketed me into the fourth dimension of existence. I will be forever grateful for her and every other teacher that God has put in my life and sponsor. See, for over 2 years, I was saying I'm an alcoholic. I didn't even know what that meant. I had no idea what I was suffering from. I thought it meant I drank too much. I didn't know that I suffered from a threefold disease, an allergy. The doctor's opinion. When I sat down and read the doctor's opinion with this woman, all she did was make me show up. The only thing that a sponsor can't do for me that I can't do with the woman I sponsor is give them willingness. The willingness has got to come from within me. And before I can even start to admit I'm powerless over alcohol, I need to know what it means to be an alcoholic. And I can't diagnose any of you, and she couldn't diagnose me. And this is where the identification comes in. It's my experience that makes me an alcoholic, not yours and not hers. And we sat down, and this book started to come alive based on my experience. And she explained to me about the allergy, an abnormal reaction, a phenomenon of craving, Mary Beth. Yeah, but Lily, some nights I can only have one, and I don't want another one. That's not what the doctor's opinion says. This craving never happens to an average drinker, to a person who does not suffer from this allergy. They never get the craving. Look at your sisters. They have a drink, they go home. You have a drink, you're out for a year. You want the next one. You have no control over the amount that I drink once I put a drink to my lips. The first drink gets you drunk. That's ridiculous. That's not what gets me drunk. You people are what gets me drunk. My parents, my employers, my friends. All you people who don't... No. 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 It's this allergy. You do not react to alcohol like a normal person does. Then you couple that with this mental obsession. I told you, when I had my first beer at the age of 13, I was plotting the next one. I was in, you know, Friday night came, I was in the following Thursday morning. I was never present to where my feet were, never. My thinking mind was always, what's next, what's next? Where am I going to... The words that used to make me shiver and shudder and just make me crazy were last call. I panicked. Everyone's ready to go home, and I'm like, let the party begin. That's your experience, Mary. That's what I understood in my innermost self, conceding to my innermost self what it means to be an alcoholic. So here's where these contradictions in my life started. Stop looking on the outside, Mary Beth, and start to look within. First step in recovery, concede to yourself. That hole in the soul, fill that. The spiritual malady, the restless, irritable, and discontent, this is where I tell you that I understand my story as I continue to do this work. I suffered from that in first grade when I didn't get picked to do a reading. My second four-step inventory revealed that to me. Not my first one, because I wasn't supposed to remember it then. My second four-step inventory revealed to me that in first grade, I felt different. Way before I picked up a drink, I was suffering from restless, irritable, and discontent. We read the doctor's opinion last night in our home group. I can suffer from that tomorrow, last week. I had a sponsee once call me on it with my shoes. That was really humbling. Well, you're never satisfied. How many pairs of shoes do you have in your closet? You know, I can always look to try for something on the outside to fill what's the void on the inside. And today I know the only thing that can fill it is the God of my own understanding. I tried home groups. I wanted to kill you. I tried sponsors. I put them on podiums. They're human. I'm a human being. None of that stuff has ever worked for me. God could and would if he restored it. Mary Beth, he's been there all along. It's the stuff from first grade that you put on there. Then you put drugs and alcohol on top of it, and it never has to see the light of day. But if it doesn't see the light of day, you're always going to be blocked. You're going to be sitting in an AA meeting wanting to kill people. I've got to get what's blocking me from that sunlight. Seek. God does not make too hard terms to those who seek Him. Every single morning, God, I need to seek the vision of His will because my will is still warped. My thinking can still go astray. Look within. Look within. Choice. One choice. God is everything or He is nothing. I hate the word all. A-L-L, three letters. Not, here, God, you take this stuff and I'll handle the rest of this. Well, He took my drinking. I wasn't drinking. But the rest of me was ready to kill everyone. Because I don't want to give you that. And I still have problems giving Him stuff. I started a new job. Financial insecurity? Let me hold on to that. After all He's given me, I still question Him. I still do. I want to take it back. I want to take it back. God is everything or nothing. Not God is. Everything. And when I make that decision, when I get down on my knees, you know, relieve me of Mary Beth. I'm the problem. I am so selfish and self-centered and fearful. I would have never told you. Not me. I'm a strong person. I'm not afraid of any of you. I was a scared little girl in a big girl's body. And I still can be. I still can be. I do inventory. I do 4 through 9. And I've done multiple inventories. And my sponsor's getting ready to come up from Florida in like 2 weeks. And I'm going to get ready to do another 4th and 5th step. And I just got to like tell on myself. So you know like when you do inventory, I know sponsors do this and I do this. So you have like a week to do it. And so you come up with every single excuse you can not to write the inventory. Like you have to clean your basement, vacuum, whatever, wash windows. Never washed windows before in my life. And you cram it all the night before. Well, I know she's coming in 2 weeks. I haven't even started writing. It's starting to be like 16 years later, cramming in my 4-step inventory. That's why I got to keep coming. But, you know, I do this inventory, and I stop pointing fingers. First time in my life I looked at me. And I'm the common denominator in all this. It doesn't even matter who's in the first couple of columns. That doesn't even matter. It's the way that I show up. The way that I show up. And I sit down across the table and tell a person all of my deepest, darkest secrets. I don't know about you guys, but I wasn't telling any. I was filled with such guilt, shame, and remorse. I was going to my grave with my secrets. I wasn't telling you anything. And the 5th step, after I admitted to God and then to myself, because I wouldn't have a problem admitting it to you. I'll tell you anything you want to hear, but I need to admit it to me first. See, again, the contradiction, remember, to look within, not out there, look within. Admit it to myself and to another human being, the exact nature of my wrongs. And I've done that. And I find out that I'm selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, inconsiderate, all these character defects that I get to on a daily basis. That helps keep me fit spiritually is just offer them up to the God of my own understanding. Because along this way, I've started to develop a relationship with God. I love where it says in Bill's story, choose your own conception. I don't care who the God of your own understanding is. Just find Him. I don't care what He looks like. I don't care what He does for you. Just find Him and tap into it. And tap into it because that is the solution. The book tells me that, and the book has come alive for me, and that is my experience. The solution lies in the God of my own understanding, which I get to on a daily basis. Just say, God, take all of me, the good and the bad. I don't know the difference. What I think is good is bad and vice versa. Helps right-size me, shrinks my big ego and my pride that I have, because I still want you all to like me, and I want to be the person that you want me to be, and God helps me to be humble. And my sponsor and my sponsees and the people around me helped to right-size me. I had no idea how much damage my drinking really did. But with the help of loving sponsors, I get a list of all the people that I harmed. I had no idea how much harm I caused. See, at the end of my drinking, I was just going home to my apartment. and closing the shades down. What damage could I possibly be doing? I was so wrong. I understood, I felt inside what it meant to my dad when he told me that he was just waiting for the phone to ring for someone to tell him that I had died. I stole so much from that man, and this process, the direct amends, because I got an A+ in saying, I am so sorry, I'll never do that again. I swear, I promise. Whatever it is you wanted to hear, I'd say it so I could get something back. And an amends is the complete opposite of that. It's about changing. It's about becoming back to the person God wants me to be that stopped growing at the age of 13 when I picked up that Rheingold beer. And I am some of that person that he wants me to be today. And the direct amends, that's where I really started to experience the freedom. I only came back in here to get temporary relief. And thank God I've stayed, because what I've got to experience is happiness, joy, and freedom. And I really started to feel the freedom after I started to do my 9-step amends. And as of right now, there are no amends that I'm aware of that I haven't made. And some of them were really hard. I was so afraid. And not only did I have to have a God who was there with me, but I really had to trust him. And I really had to start taking a lot of leaps of faith. And today I get to live in steps 10, 11, and 12. 10th step, I have a sponsor who insists on 10th step inventory at night. I'm not perfect with it. I will tell you that when I do it, the next day, my day turns out to be so much better, because in the morning I bring corrective measures into carrying the vision of God's will. When I don't, remember how I told you I can either grow closer to or further away? When I don't write the inventory, the most spiritual tool I have is a pen, black and white. Stuff showed up on my inventory. I don't even know who wrote it. I pray to God, and the pen just goes. And it's the same thing that happens in 10-step inventory. And then the next morning, I get to start the day just a little bit different based on what I wrote the night before. Prayer and meditation is just me tapping into this power that has given me a life far beyond anything I ever could have imagined. And I get to do all of that so that I can give it back. It's the only thing Lily asked me. When the time is right and God puts a woman in your life, just pass it on to her. And I've been fortunate and blessed to be able to do that. And what a joy to see the lights come on in someone else's eyes. Life will take on a new meaning is an understatement when I get to sit across the table. And sometimes I don't want to do it. I told her myself with Sarah. She called me last week and was like, I don't know if your husband told you, but if he didn't, that's okay. I can get someone else. And I immediately went, oh, my God, I have an out. And I knew. And so here goes the alcoholic thinking. Oh, my God, I could tell her I didn't know. I don't have to go. You know, I can't live that way anymore. That's not the person that I want to be today. I've been able to fill my lesses with fulls. Helpless, helpful. Hopeless, hopeful. Thankless, thankful. You know, all that stuff, that's what this process has enabled me to do. And giving it back is just the icing on the cake. And I don't just give it back to the alcoholics, in all my affairs. To my family, you know, I told you we were a family that never even hugged each other or kissed each other or said, I love you. And I don't know if it's because of the way that I practice these principles. My father absolutely loved Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the first one at my celebrations before he died. He would, you know, one time at one of my celebrations, he put $20 in the basket. And the guy next to him said, no, you get some change. And he goes, there isn't enough money in the world that I could give to an organization that gave me back my daughter. That's what you guys have done. He was always the first. He would always say, do you belong, you know, if you say, hi, I'm a friend of your daughter, Mary Beth, she'd go, do you belong to her club? And I said to him, Dad, you can't say that because it's anonymous. And so he'd go, do you belong to her club? Don't worry, I won't tell anyone. and he would, like, tell people, right? When I was making the amends with them at Seton Hall, I thought he told his whole building. I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to walk in there. They're all going to know I'm making a direct amends because, and I saw so much from him. And then he goes, you were the one who was stealing my money all the time. So, you know, he thought it was my sister and my brother. So I had to make amends to them. I had so many financial amends. Oh, my God. And I had to thank God for sponsors that love you enough to tell you the truth and don't let you get off. This woman, she didn't care. If I told her I stole $100, she said it's $200 and you're paying interest, it's $250. And I paid back all my financial amends. I'm just going to end with this. When I came back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, remember I told you fashionably late, I'm not going to, I don't want any of you guys anywhere near me. I'm feeling better. You know, I had the thought that maybe I might even go out and drink that day. And the door slams shut, and I sit next to this woman. And after the meeting, she turns and extends her hands to me. And she goes, hi, my name is Alice, with this big smile on her face. And I'm like, oh, God. So, because, see, I wanted to just run out of there. I wasn't going to talk to anyone. You know, I just wanted to hightail it out of there and never come back. I had no intentions of coming back because you're talking about God. And she goes, are you new? And, of course, it's like we have it, like, stamped on our foreheads, you know, like, new. And so I'm like, I am. And she goes, how are you? And I said, I don't know how I'm going to stay sober on New Year's Eve. It's exactly what I said to her. And she goes, it's not even Thanksgiving. And, see, that was my biggest worry because I hadn't been sober on a New Year's Eve since I was 13. I go, I don't know how I'm going to stay sober on a New Year's Eve. That's a whole other story, what happened on New Year's Eve. But anyway, I didn't pick up a drink. But anyway, so she says to me, she goes, oh, honey, she goes, you know, can you just not drink today? I'm like, well, I don't know. And she said, yesterday's gone and tomorrow's not here. How about just for today you don't drink? And I'm thinking, this lady is so old. She's probably my age now. I'm like, this lady is so old. She's so freaking corny. I cannot believe this. So I'm like, fine, whatever, you know, with my flip attitude. And she goes, how about you come a couple of minutes early tomorrow and I'll save a seat for you? I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. And I'm like, to myself, I'm not coming back. You're a bunch of losers. I want nothing to do with your fellowship with Alcoholics Anonymous, like losers. I'm not coming back. So I'm like, fine, whatever. And I leave that day, and all day long, I'm like tossing and turning. You know, that night, I'm like, I'm not going back there. And I could hear my mother saying, you have to. This nice lady's going to be waiting for you. She extended your hand. I'm having a conversation with my mom. I'm not going. They're losers. I'm not going back there. You have to. You have to. You have to. I went back the next morning, and Alice was sitting there waiting for me with a big smile on her face and an empty chair. And she gave me a big hug, and she welcomed me back when I never even wanted to be there. And that's why I am responsible when anyone, anywhere, reaches out. May the hand of AA always be there for you like it was there for me that morning. So thank you all for being here tonight. Thanks.